So it's a little bit colder now than it's been. Perfect weather for football, right? Because this is Canada. I don't know if any of you follow World Cup or pre-World Cup. There's so many different soccer leagues, but follow kind of international soccer at all. If you do, you might know that Canada has been doing exceptionally well, historically speaking, in this regard. Recently had a game with Mexico, played in Edmonton. In the snow. And so if there's such a thing as sort of geographic soccer revenge, that was probably it, right? Because not that long ago, like, they were playing in Mexico and going, what do you, how do you even play soccer when it's 44 degrees or whatever? And now it's, these folks that usually play in Mexico City or in Edmonton kind of going, this ball doesn't bounce when it's frozen. Like, how do we do this? How do we play this game in these conditions? So winter's coming, right? I mean, today the temperature's supposed to go down during the day, and we're there. It's December. This had to happen sooner or later. But in that prolonged period of mild late November, we had a few days, and we maybe I don't know, maybe we noticed this differently because we're driving from outside the city a little more. But we had a few days where the driving conditions were like really icy, and even just walking around on the streets, never mind our driveway. Thanks for navigating that. They were pretty. It was pretty slick, and so. Our driveway's still kind of like that. I really have done what I could, but it's still like whoa, right? So stuff is icy, and that all reminded me that driving on ice sometimes requires paying more attention to momentum than we usually do. Slow down and then turn. If you need to use the brakes, do it when you're traveling in a straight line, not when you're also trying to change directions. A body in motion stays in motion. A body at rest stays at rest. That's a very much a shortened paraphrase of Isaac Newton's first law, sometimes called the law of inertia, which forms the basis for classical mechanics. I had occasion a few years ago to stand on Isaac Newton's grave, and I was thinking about this law: a body at rest stays at rest. Anyway, there he is. Sure enough, not going anywhere. Anyway, the law has some limitations, and things like the theory of relativity and quantum theory give it a pretty rough ride under a lot of circumstances, but it still does a pretty good job of informing much of what we experience about things like momentum in everyday life, and like when we're driving on icy roads. That kind of seems to work for the most part, right? For me, it also provides a way of picturing what's going on with other kinds of direction change. And I spend a lot more time thinking about culture than I do about science. And culture, even in these days of rapid cultural change, still exhibits a kind of momentum that makes changes in direction sometimes hazardous, sometimes slow, and I would say always challenging. So, as part of kind of tapping the brakes so we can continue to make a much needed change in direction, let's pause to remember that we are gathering on Treaty One territory today. On the original lands of Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. That's already a familiar sentence in our cultural context. And with familiar sentences, it's easy to stop thinking about them. There are a couple of different ways we could think about momentum and the change idea in light of that acknowledgement. One is that as a culture, we are trying to change directions from the trajectory that's set by the forces of colonialism. The attempted suppression of indigenous culture, people, and practices, that free roaming extraction of resources that arguably motivated sort of the primary colonial impulse, the brutality that's increasingly being understood as the defining characteristic of the collusion of church and state and the attempted genocide of the first peoples of the continent. These are things that there was. That we're trying to change direction from, right? So that's one way to think about that. And when I think about it that way, tapping the brakes feels like too little, too late. Can't we just kind of turn the corner and hit the gas on a new direction already, This might sound a little bit melodramatic, but it seems to me that not doing the necessary work of slowing down before we turn might give us a new direction, but it might also give us a car crash. Let's do this in terms of direction change by all means, and let's do this as fast as we can, which will probably almost always be slower than we want it to be. Waiting is part of change, just as surely as action is part of change. Another way that we could look at that story is that all the things that we see going on and around us regarding, say, truth and reconciliation could be understood as trying to recover from the skid that is colonialism. So in the first picture, I was thinking of colonialism as the direction, and the skid is what we're is the change we're in the midst of. The other way I'm suggesting we might look at this is to say, nope, colonialism actually wasn't the direction of the momentum. Colonialism was already us as a culture in a skid. In that imagined picture, the cultural direction of travel was already set by the people that were here. It was already set by the indigenous peoples. By their practices, by their culture, by their spirituality, that cult, there was already a full-blown cultural direction present in this part of the world when the colonizers got here. And what we're trying to clean up now is the wreckage that is strewn everywhere from the cataclysm that results from the colonial attempt to turn that already existing culture in a totally different direction at full speed without any consideration of the direction it was already going. Different picture. From our present vantage point, I think we're sort of maybe starting to see that while any culture needs to evolve, trying to force that evolution just doesn't work any more than tromping on the gas is going to get us a better result on an icy road. Now, here's a question. Is this just a pet divergence of mine, you know? Or does this all have something to do with the exploration of Advent that I promised in the blurb? So, as is often the case, let's see if I can pull the strings into something woven together. Advent is an idea. I think, well, let's see, maybe it would be more correct to say that in historic Christian practice, it's a collection of ideas and rituals. And I think that's important to acknowledge at the outset because that means it's something that we, as humans, made. And that means that we can both stand back from it and examine it, and that it's open to things like reconsideration or change or replacement or dismissal. It's also available for engagement. It's also available for application as a practice, if that's what we suspect might be the spiritually enriching path for us. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on history here. For our purposes, it's noteworthy that, like the stories that it draws upon, Advent is not a uniform practice, even within its own traditions of origin. How many weeks long it is, what it's aimed at, what spiritual focus it has, what rituals attend to it. There's just lots of variation around this thing that we might sort of generally call Advent. These days, in this part of the world, it's most often the 4 weeks before Christmas, and when it's paid attention to at all, it's most often as a kind of like run-up to the big one, you know, to the Christmas Eve in particular, in those rhythms. And this is traditional focus on Christmas Eve, of course, on the narratives about the birth of Jesus. And so in a lot of communities' practices of Advent, it's aimed at that. And that's kind of how it behaves. Christmas, of course, is still a handy place to store a lot of sentimentality. I'm not here personally to be dismissive about that. Sometimes we need something sweet in our lives, and for some of us, Christmas seems to be a pretty fine vehicle for that experience. But for many, that sentimental version of Christmas and all things related feels either like the way you feel after you eat all the candy in your stocking at one go, or like consumerism dressed up as religion, or like a too insistent in-group naming of a time of year that acts like other traditions or practices are the enemy. I think it's important to acknowledge that, if only to keep us clear of the trap of thinking that everyone that doesn't love Christmas is the enemy of everyone that does. We really do not need more occasions for that kind of thinking. We really don't. Now, what if Advent could provide sort of a possible window of meaning, if you will, that stood in a creative space that was accessible to both the traditionalists and those less inclined in that direction? This might be impossible, but I'm intrigued to see if there's a way to sort of rescue some aspects of Advent from the trash can of religious overreach and to repurpose them as tools for meaning making in the right here and the right now. Because you know I like words, and because in these moments in our community, I get to choose. Let's start there. So the word Advent comes from, no surprise, the Latin. Its most common usage these days is meaning the arrival of a notable person, thing, or event. Sort of as in, you know, with the advent of streaming services, we can indulge in binge watching, you know, fill in the blank more easily than ever before or whatever. So that's kind of, you know, used in a sentence. In the Christmas tradition, it's usually the first season of the calendar. So in the Christian year, because yes, there is such a thing, it starts with Advent. That's January 1st, you know, it's 4 weeks before Christmas Eve, right? So kind of this whole own thing. So it's the four Sundays before Christmas. In Christian theology, I was thinking about that word theology a little bit when I was writing this. I'm not going to talk about this now, but it kind of comes with all of this freight, and it's just an English word that's like our ideas about the divine. I mean, it's kind of not in a category by itself linguistically, but I think lots of us have heard it treated that way. Anyway, in Christian theology, that word Advent applies to, typically in that framework, it applies to the soon coming, the coming of, and the second coming of Christ. And that's sort of what Advent is aimed at as an idea. In terms of the word itself, the Latin parent word is Adventus. And Adventus just means arrival or approach. So basically, in that set of ideas, something important is coming. Get ready. Now, if you grew up Christian, you know what has been made of those ideas within the tradition. The people are oppressed and need to be saved. The world is in distress and needs to be saved. The Savior is coming. The Savior has come. And having come once and left, is coming again. And so, in the Christian tradition, that's all covered under the idea of Advent. All right. So this, I found that a little bit interesting, at least in the sense that we tend to think about it in association primarily with Christmas in the Christian tradition, and in the history of that tradition, it's actually a much larger idea than that. Now, in that tradition, in the Christian tradition, in every iteration of time, past, present, and future, for instance, the people are waiting. In that tradition, we're never not waiting. If we think the first coming of Christ has happened, we're waiting for the second. If we don't think that, then we're still waiting for the first one. Now, in our setting at the table, there is nothing like uniform belief in even the core tenets of Christianity. We're all over the map. And personally, I think that's pretty much at the center of the beauty of this community. It's certainly the reason that I continue to feel at home here. And having said that, when we come to some of these stories, when we come to these texts that are sacred in the Christian tradition, even if that's not a belief system we identify with or feel comfortable in, there might be some gems of wisdom, some long view perspectives that can help us navigate our now. So let's start, perhaps, with how much our now has in common with the ancient writers' now. So listen to this. This is from the book of Luke, the same book in the collection that has the sweetest, most often sentimentalized version of the Christian Christmas story. So in that same collection of texts, we find Jesus saying things like this. There will be signs in the sun, the moon, and the stars, and on earth distress among nations caused by the roaring of the seas and the waves. People will faint from fear and foreboding of what is coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Actually sounds an awful lot like the evening news, right? So wars, rumors of wars, upheaval in the weather, like that's all there in these ancient texts. Terror, Jesus says in those stories, will make people faint. They will be worried about what is happening in the world. He also says, don't get too distressed when this happens. I really enjoy Eugene Peterson's rendering in the Message, which you notice if I'm referencing Christian sacred texts, I often kind of include his perspective. When I disagree with him, I disagree with him so profoundly I have to close whatever I'm looking at. Like it just hits me between the eyes. But every once in a while, I feel like he does a really great job of carrying ancient ideas into modern language. And then I'm like, yeah, okay, you're all right. Anyway, you know, so this is one of those times where I sort of felt like I really like this rendering. So This is the way Peterson renders it. So this is these are in Luke. This is Jesus talking. Okay. So when you hear of wars and uprisings, and that's referencing that whole list of apocalyptic things that preceded that text. When you hear of wars and uprisings, keep your head and don't panic. This is routine history and no sign of the end. You got to remember, like, Jesus as a Jewish rabbi is talking to a culture that is apocalyptic as a mindset. They're like, they're ready for the end. It's imminent all the time. And not really a big surprise given their history as a nation, right? You get displaced often enough. You get to be collective refugees often enough. You live under the oppression of the highly systematized squashing of the Roman Empire long enough. You live with the uncertainty of whether you'll survive walking to the market and back long enough. And your mindset is the end is imminent. My end is imminent. Our collective end as a people is imminent, I'm afraid. So that's what Jesus is talking to, right? When he says, keep your head, don't panic. This is routine history and no sign of the end. What this all has to do with Advent is that waiting in this collection of stories about trying to understand how the world works is often about how we respond to scary events, but it's not about the planet crumbling into dust. Easy mistake to make, though, if we just read the stories with our modern kind of linear take on time in particular. And here's what I mean by that. Let's consider for a moment how we think about time. The ancient writers weren't nearly so captivated by our modern linearity in general, and that's also true about their perspective on time. So it's important to remember that if we do reference these texts looking for applicable wisdom, for enduring themes, it's worth remembering that the writers were not, they weren't writing to us, no matter what your youth group pastor told you, or wherever you heard it. I'm just thinking of a sort of a condensed version that we might have heard somewhere growing up religious. They're not thinking about time the way we think about time. They're not thinking about the end of the world the way we think about the end of the world, if we think about it. They're pre-nuclear, among other things. You know, the idea that someone could push the wrong button and wipe the whole thing out, not on their radar. But the idea of not surviving the day, that's on their radar. Time, the writers of these ancient texts understood, was something that ultimately functioned without our input. So if you want to put that into God language, perhaps, you could say their perspective was that time is in the hands of God. It's in the hands of something beyond us, outside of us. So that's why, for example, when Job is in full cry about why me toward the end of that that little theater piece that is the book of Job, the God character in that play says, where were you when this whole thing got started? Which is really just another way of saying, what do you know about time? Right? Like, you don't really know what you're talking about, do you? Even in the context of a story like Job, which is clearly not a depiction of any reality we can grasp, time is a blurry concept. In contemporary terms, we could approach that with some questions like this. When is now? That just went by, didn't it? When is now? When does the future arrive? When is a moment gone? Or conversely, when do we have that moment? See what I mean? Time is a slippery idea. And that's without even getting into the realm of, you know, parallel universes or other time warpy sorts of ideas. So when these ancient stories talk about waiting, they're not describing something on a timeline with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that's why when the biblical writers talk about the end of time or end times or the end, they're not talking about something like the Mayan calendar idea of history as we know it coming to a conclusion. If we're probably past the best before date on that particular prophecy anyway, aren't we? Wasn't that 2012 when the universal devastation was supposed to strike? If history teaches us anything, it should teach us about the inherent hazards of putting a date on that cataclysm. What these biblical writers are on about is the uncertainty and violence of human history. Signs of dread, floods, earthquakes, distress among nations that cause us as human beings to feel afraid, to feel faint with fear. And when Jesus, in the context of these same ideas, says all this will happen before the end of this generation, which is part of what's in that same Luke text, he isn't saying history will come to an end before you people that I'm talking to are dead and gone. He's saying this stuff happens to every generation. So try not to get yourselves wrapped up in too tight a knot about it. Most of us in this room have lived through a particularly vocal expression of Christian ideology that has made a pretty big deal out of the end times. Anybody else here wake up in the house in the middle of the night as a kid and it was really quiet and you wondered if maybe your parents got taken and you got left behind? True story. Walked down the hall and looked in. Fortunately, didn't interrupt anything I shouldn't interrupt. That'd be a different trauma, I'm sure. They were there. It was all good. That particular movement happened in ways that emphasized the, if you believe the right things, you're going to get yanked out of this mess before things really hit the fan interpretation of those same texts that I've just been talking about. And I would say that ideology made that case with careless disregard for the planet and for the poor and for peace in general. It's been more about escapism than about engagement. It's been more about getting rescued than about doing our part to bring what we'll save to the place that we call home. In other words, it's de-emphasized the essential human task of bringing salvation, if you will, to our here and now. Earlier this week, Misty, you sent me an interesting quote on Advent. It read, "Part of the gift of Advent is to be immersed in the darkness without projecting our fears onto it. To become receptive and patient, to open into stillness and space, to find hope in the reckoning and faith in rising together." Perhaps we could say, to acknowledge the uncertainty and violence of human history, but not to lose our heads, to choose instead to let the darkness flow around us without letting it crush us, to not confuse the water we're swimming in with who we are, and to continue with the work of both reckoning — that's the kind of work we were talking about when we started this exploration, the work of acknowledging what is true, even if it's difficult and messy. So to continue the work of both reckoning and of faith, of leaning into what we don't know, trusting that we are equipped by love to help one another to rise together. Waiting is not passivity. I mean, we can wait passively. But waiting, as any contemplative will tell you, is real work if we do it as an engaged person. That quote that you sent, Misty, being immersed in the darkness without projecting our fears onto it, that's real work. Swimming in the water of change in a culture, swimming in the water of change in our personal journeys, spiritual journeys, ideological journeys, practices. It's real work. And it is also a kind of waiting. This is not about beginning, middle, and end, right? It's more like choosing to move into something that's always expanding. So there will always be a part of change that is about waiting. And if remembering some of the history of Advent can inform our waiting, better, can make it deeper, richer, more engaged, more meaningful, then I think that's a practice worth some of our time and attention. Again, each person would know for themselves, you know, but that would be how it feels to me. All right. Peace, everybody.